Blog Talk Radio.
To another program of Fightin' Words on the Fightin' Words News Network. Fightin' Words is brought to you each and every night of the week in grateful appreciation to the men and women of the United States Armed Forces and the men and women of Police and Fire Services by Dr. Kathleen Carroll, a board-certified psychiatrist in private practice since 2003. Previously, Dr. Carroll was a director of medicine at the Bay Pines VA Hospital and the Bay Pines VA Medical Center. Dr. Carroll is, it's really a bad night here tonight. Specializes in the treatment of children 6 and older and for adults. She's also an all-time triathlete. If you're having a problem with life, please, please don't take it out on a policeman, fireman, or your neighbor. Please seek professional help. We also have a second sponsor. If you're moving, think about moving in Florida, in the Sarasota, Manatee area. There's a group put together by Mr. Joe Giordino at the Weicker Realty Group in Sarasota. His team is fully knowledgeable of the area. They're experienced, they're easy to work with, and honest. If you have a chance to give them a call, call Joe at 941-876-8877. Guys, this was a, man, what a week, huh? Nothing but
yes, sir. How you doing today,
stuff.
Butch? Do you know how you guys are
doing? Good. Doing good.
Good. Good to hear.
Good to have everybody back on. Well, we have a listener calling in. I'll let you guys start with last week's, I guess, I'm at a loss for words, but the Kovalev fight.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I'm not at a loss for words. Well, first of all, I want to start the show off. I apologize for missing last week. I am relatively headache-free. And I also want to say how much of a pleasure it was just to see the Carroll family again with my own set of eyes after some years. So, I mean, lovely, lovely family. I am so pleasured and honored to know the Carroll. So I just want to put that out there.
Yeah, definitely. What'd you think of the fight, Cito? I mean, Eleider Alvarez came in as the underdog. We all thought he was live, but I don't think anyone expected him to upset the apple cart the way he did.
Well, I mean, it all comes down to holes. Everyone has holes. Everyone has
right.
holes. And it is a fight. You know, I mean, some guys get caught. I never thought Kovalev was the most durable guy. He's a tough guy now. Don't get it wrong, because
the guy
has taken shots. I've seen him taking shots, but I mean, to be honest, Kovalev. I mean, who's the biggest hitter he's faced? People have to think about
Pascal,
that.
Yeah, Pascal maybe.
Who's the biggest puncher?
Right, yeah.
So he hasn't fought a line of really big hitters in light heavyweight division.
Well, Alvarez wasn't considered a big hitter either, though.
Exactly. Well, really, you know, neither was Ward, but he's been stopped. He was stopped by Ward. Although you could say body shots or whatever, he was stopped. So now with Alvarez, holes. His holes in the game. Kovalev, he was winning the fight. I mean, he was doing things, but you could see, you know, kind of along. Mm-hmm. Alvarez was getting closer. Alvarez, he started doing some very, very good things. And the good things he was doing were hard, and they were kind of meant for that moment. I mean, a guy could keep kind of grinding, you know, to a decision that way. But to be honest, I mean, he was swinging the tide, looking for that moment, and Kovalev was open
yes,
for
he
that.
Was.
I mean, he was open for that. And to be honest, that's a style thing. He got caught kind of off of his style.
And you know what? Andre Ward caught him with a similar right hand. And I think what it is, too, is Kovalev, he has this piercing style where he kind of likes to step in and out of range with long, hard, straight, you know, lefts and rights. He's not a big head mover, doesn't slip a lot of punches. That's not his game. It's not the way he fights. What it is now, too, is, you know, when a boogeyman gets defeated, a lot of times people, when they start to lose after that, people say, well, you know, maybe they're done, yada, yada, yada. Well, a big part of what happens is that aura of invincibility around them has been shattered. And so now fighters are no longer as concerned with standing in a certain range or stepping into a range because they said, you know what, if you do that, you can beat this guy. That hole in Kovalev's defense, that flaw you spoke of, has always been there. It's nothing new. It's always been there. It's just a hole in his game. And Alvarez was a guy who weathered the storm. A lot of Kovalev's opponents didn't weather the storm. They didn't stand close enough to have to deal with the storm. Alvarez weathered the storm and kept putting himself in position, like you said, to land that shot, to land a fight-changing shot, and he did so. He really did so.
Yeah, and Kovalev, he still has the habits. He tried to go to the body more effectively, and he did. But he still had the habit of not going to the body. Kovalev, he has a habit. He is a darter. He darts in and out with his hands down. if a guy gets a timing on you darting, then he has a shot of catching you. As simple as that. Especially
he just has to be willing to stand in and throw the shot. And that's what happens a lot of times. When that boogeyman gets beat, guys are more willing to stand in and throw the shot.
Or after they weather that storm.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, which Alvarez did.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did it very well. Can you imagine what
I was going to say, even if Alvarez didn't catch Kovalev, what he had showed during that fight was it was going to be a dogfight for 12 rounds. Kovalev was going to have to earn that decision. It wasn't going to be given to him. Alvarez was there and he was live.
And in my estimation, the fight was going against Kovalev as it was going on. If the knockout shot wouldn't have happened, then the fight was swinging Alvarez's way anyway, in the fact that Kovalev was getting a little less offensively effective. Alvarez was having more command of the ring. And he was touching on Kovalev a little more, getting a little closer. So even with that, he would have started bagging rounds.
Once Alvarez withstood that fourth round, you could see a little of the steam come off of Kovalev's punches. By the time they got into towards the end of the fight, if you pay attention, Alvarez, like Zito said, had command of the ring. He was actually taking center ring and starting to walk Kovalev down a bit. So even though on the scorecards, Kovalev, quite conceivably was up. It was a close fight. He would have only been up by one or two rounds. But even though at the time of the stoppage he was up, if your eyes know what they're watching, you could see kind of the momentum shifting and the fight taking on a different nature, which is why I said Kovalev was going to have to earn that fight. One thing about Kovalev is his power is real. And that threat of power allows him to be a front runner at times. Guys don't step and make it as aggressive a dogfight as they need to because they don't want to get caught with anything. What Andre Ward showed is if you can step in and make it a dogfight, then you have a chance to beat the guy. And so now, like I said, more guys are likely to do that. Alvarez had already kind of withstood the offensive onslaught. And from that point on, like Zito said, it was just a matter of him finding the shot that he had been looking for.
Can you imagine what the guys in Vegas must have thought the next morning? Because that fight went off with Kovalev up 500 points.
Yeah.
That must have cost a lot of money. A lot of people lost a lot of money on that one. The undercard on that was Dmitry Bivol, right? He retained his title with the Bivol. Yeah, he retained his title with, I'm sorry?
Archelumber.
Yeah. What did you think of that fight?
No, to me, that was a pretty good fight. Archelumber, he's a tough, wily guy. He's going to be there. And he's awkward. So he's not a guy that you're just going to, he's not conventional. He's not a guy you're just going to figure out and do what you're going to do. He's going to be all over the place, different angles, tough guy, could take a shot, and he offers something offensive. So, I Chalumba's not a walkover guy. With that said, Bivol, he was patient. He showed me a couple things. He showed me he was patient. He showed me he had some power. Shows me he has discipline. Shows me also he needs to learn a little bit more. He did what he's supposed to do, and that's a win. It depends who he's fighting next. Some guys, I think he has a very, he can beat, outright beat. Other guys, I think he may need a little bit more seasoning in terms of a fight or two. And just as far as, just to get that, because he still has holes, too. He has holes. He's an aggressive guy, and I love the way he fights. I love the way he fights. But at times, he'll get over-aggressive with his chin in the air. He'll sacrifice his range. He'll do too much at times to me, offensively, to where he can maximize what he does even in a more punishing way instead of always throwing – because he has a habit of – he'll get in the habit of throwing hard, a lot of stuff hard. to where he could throw stuff to set up some hard knockout shots, I think, behind his distance, behind his footwork. He has very good in and out and side to side footwork to get power shots off. To decrease his range, he'll use his long shots, and then he'll move off to the side and get his power shots off. The only thing is he'll stand, sometimes he'll stand in front of you and try a little too hard with his chin in the air, and and that'll get him caught. But outside of that, I mean he looks good. He looks good.
Ty?
So when you talk about light heavyweight, and you talk about your elite fighters at light heavyweight, Adonis Stevenson is 40 years old. Sergey Kovalev, 35 years old. Manu Jack, 34 going on 35 years old, I believe. Bernard Beterbiev is 33 years old. Daniil is 31 years old. And then you have Bivol, who's only 27. So by quite some years, Bivol is the youngest of this elite crop of light heavyweights. Even the new kid on the block who crashed the party last week, Alvarez, is 34 years old. You know, relatively low miles on his odometer, but 34 nonetheless. So Bivol, out of all these guys, has the most time to grow and you know mature into a fighter. Most of these other guys are kind of who they are going to be. From a matchmaking standpoint, I want to credit Kathy Duva, a friend, with the way she's matched Bivol very recently. I thought the Sullivan-Rivera fight was a good fight to see where he was at. It's a fight he was supposed to win, but it was a fight where he was going to be challenged, and he was, and he passed it with flying colors. And then I think coming off that fight, Ike Chalemba was the perfect fight for him. Ike Chalemba's the kind of guy who, for a prospect or a contender or a champion like Bivol, Chalemba's not necessarily a threat to beat you. He doesn't have the power to get you out of there, and he really has to, you know, a guy like Bivol is supposed to beat Chalemba, but the thing about Chalemba is you never look good beating him. He was only stopped once, and that was because he broke his hand against the nail. So Chalemba's the guy who's going to give you rounds, and more importantly, for a guy like Bivol, he's going to give you a learning experience, which is why I think from a matchmaking standpoint, Sullivan Brera, Chalemba, two guys who could give you a lot of rounds and you can learn a lot while you're fighting them. With that said, the strength that Bivol displayed, in addition to his weaknesses, I think Zito touched on that brilliantly. I completely agree with Zito with his strengths and weaknesses. But great matchmaking, it was a good fight. Bivol has some things to work on, but again, by far, he is the youngest of the crop.
Great. Yeah. Yep. You know, the other question I had on last week's program that they had out there was Andre Berto had a very strong outing against Devin Alexander. That was one I totally missed that one.
Well, I don't think Berto won the fight. I watched the fight. And Alexander got stale in the second half, just as he did against Victor Ortiz. But in both cases, in my opinion, he had done enough to win. He should have won the decision. I thought he got the raw end of the deal in both cases. A draw and a loss should have been, to me, two wins. With that said, the fact that Alexander kind of stagnated in the second half of the fight, it showed me that Alexander is not what he was. You know, he had an opioid addiction, and it's robbed him of a little bit of his prime, and he just doesn't seem to be the same specimen as a fighter he was. And it allowed an Andre Berto, who is clearly past it, to claw his way back in the fight. So I think for me it was more a referendum on where Devin Alexander is. Again, even though I thought he won the fight, it was more a referendum on where he's at this stage in his career. Andre Berto is Andre Berto. He steps up that next level. He's going to get beat again. I like the guy, but, you know, he always was what he was, and at this stage he's, you know, he's past his best. His reflexes have definitely dulled. So, again, to me, knew what Andre Berto was going in, was a little disappointed with Devin Alexander's performance. When it happened against Ortiz, I understood he had been out of the ring. He was working himself back into it, you know, first fight back in a little bit. But this is two performances in a row where coming down the second half of the fight, you know, he kind of ran out of gas. So I think, you know, Alexander again, it was more a referendum on him than it was Berto. I don't think Berto won that fight, to be honest with you.
I agree that I think Alexander slightly edged it. I wouldn't give it to Berto. A draw, I wouldn't even be mad at, to be honest, just because Berto did kind of take the second half. But I'm going to slightly agree with you, Ty, to the point to where I don't think it was as much a referendum on Alexander's age decreasement. Just because I think if they both matched up in their primes, it'd be the same fight. I think they both decreased the same level. I think they both are like kind of who they are. Alexander, he doesn't adjust at all. What he did early in the fight was successful, but then if Berto or anybody else for that matter tends to adjust or comes back or comes stronger or just keeps coming to make it difficult, then Alexander does not adjust. He just keeps trying harder, keeps doing the same thing, keeps throwing the 1-2-3, the southpaw 1-2-3, and if he starts winging punches on the inside, he will go to the body, but, I mean, he'll do it with his hands down. He'll start, I mean, his form will start, you know, going, but that always was Alexander. I mean, he doesn't adjust. He doesn't do anything new. And that's always kind of been my issue with Alexander, that he, as talented as he is, he's only one gear mentally to a point to where this is what I'm going to do. This is what works, and this is what I'm going to do. Yeah, a fighter's supposed to go with what works, but if it doesn't work, what you're going to do? You have to do something else. You can't just keep trying harder the same thing. And that's all. That's the same Alexander I saw. Try harder against Berto. Berto, he kind of turned it up, kind of made it a little rougher. And Alexander didn't use his feet at all. He just kept falling in, trying to throw the same punches. And that's the same guy I saw years ago.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me, Ty, I got a call from Kathy earlier about are you guys going to be able to get down there next week for the fight in Atlantic City?
Oh, yeah, we weren't able to get the passes. We weren't approved for the press passes. We got approved for media day, but we didn't get approved for the fight.
Oh. That's what she called me for. And asked me if you guys had gotten the approval. I mean, if you were coming.
Oh, yeah,
I'll,
we
I'll
didn't
call.
Get approved.
I'll call them myself. See if we can't get done. Because our good friend Bernard Hopkins. No. Yeah, Bernard Hopkins is going to be there, but Bernard Fernandez is going to cover it also for us.
Bernard. Yeah, love Bernard. Love Bernard.
Yeah,
I used to watch him on the sports reporters all the time with Bill Collin and Michael Barkan. I used to that was like one of my favorite shows. I get off work and put the sports reporters on, and I loved when they had Bernard on there.
Well, he's doing the card that Russell Peltz has tonight down at the 2300.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah, the turkey took a couple of weeks off and went to New Orleans for vacation. So now he's got to work hard to make up for the money that he spent on food.
He went to the capital.
Okay.
Yeah. He said he loved. He went to Dini's. And he got on the lake there, and he loved the Ace Oyster Company on just off French, off Canal Street there. And he said he put a lot of money and many pounds on.
That's the place to do it. That is the place
sure.
to do it.
Z, can we take it just a second, Z, so you can explain the program that you have there in Wilmington?
We actually, there are a few programs. I am actually at the Fight Factory. I train, I coach, and I do some light sparring, some heavy sparring, depending on what anyone needs. We do kids and any fighters, aspiring fighters. is down 340 Robinson Lane in Wilmington, Delaware, off of Maryland Avenue. And what we do is, first of all, we have two programs. We have a drugs against gloves program, and we also have a Muay Thai against gloves program. And both are, you know, sort of fighting arts, and they're just to instill just some things for the kids in the city of Wilmington, some alternatives to dealing with, you know, some negative street, you know, situations. And, you know, and during the program, we give them some, you know, some role play street scenarios to go through, what would you do type things. We give them sets of rules that they can make up themselves, what's good and what's not good to do, just, you know, according to the gym and to society. So we try to give them, you know, other alternatives and try to make them think, you know, try to make them give them, you know, think, because they're going to be in these situations. Kids are, they're always in these situations. You have to be real with them, you know, as far as you're going to be in this situation. You can't shy away from it. What would you do? These people come around you, what would you do? You know, and so it's kind of good to, you know, get that. So these programs, they bring that, bring the attention to the kids. And once again, it's at the Fight Factory.
Yeah, we had a chance to visit the Fight Factory about a week and a half ago, and we were very impressed with the way the place is kept. It's not your normal gym where you see dirty rags all over the place or has been cleaned in about 15 years. This place was spotless. The one thing I was impressed with is they were working with kids, and they were just as he said, they were giving them positive role models, and they were teaching while they had them in the ring and when they had them out of the ring. And if there's anyone who has, as we know, we get to the end of the year and you're looking for a tax donation, please think of the Fight Factory in Wilmington, Delaware. You can contact us here at the station at 347-202-0832, and we'll be able to give you the information that you may need. And we're looking for some corporate sponsors, which we just may have had a shot on today. So we'll let you know more about that as the week goes on. Wow, we got a big name in the industry giving out some advice. Did you have to see Mr. Lennox Lewis warning of to Deontay Wilder and Anthony Joshua?
Well, I heard that Lennox Lewis said something to the effect of Eddie Hearn needs to tell Anthony Joshua to fight Deontay Wilder. Yeah, just because off of legacy, talking about legacy, I don't know. That's I don't know really what to take of that, to be honest.
Actually, the way I read it was that Lennox Lewis, the actual quote was that he was saying that Anthony Joshua needs to tell Eddie Hearn to make that fight.
Yeah.
He said that Joshua needs to take his career in his hands. And with Lennox Lewis, you guys got to kind of remember the era he was coming from, which of course we do. But remember what happened to him. He was supposed to have a big unification against Riddick Bowe. And that didn't happen. Title got thrown in the trash can. So that fight never materialized. Even though he went on to fight Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield, he fought both of those guys when they were all a little bit past their prime. He was supposed to fight in his prime the Riddick Bowe of the world. And so what he is seeing, what he is witnessing, is the same thing kind of happening, a potential of a super fight that will capture everyone's imagination at heavyweight going by the wayside because of politics. He's watching the same thing happening. And what he knows, and he would know better than anybody, he's objective, he's in England. He knows why the fight's not getting made. In spite of all the speculation that goes on in the media, don't you guys think Lennox Lewis would be more in the know than the average person as to why the fight's not being made? And the fact of the matter is one thing we all know is if the fighter wants the fight to be made, it will be made.
Yeah.
And if Anthony Joshua goes to him and says, I want this fight next, that fight gets done. And whether we agree with it or not, because there is a business, this is not, you know, this is boxing business, right? This is a fight for business. This is not just a sport where no one gets paid. This is about making money. So obviously, you know, Eddie Hearn being a promoter, being a businessman, has, you know, different agenda in mind. But with that said, Lennox Lewis is speaking from the spirit and the heart and the mind of a fighter, and specifically from one who watched an opportunity like this go by the wayside before. He doesn't want to see that happen in this generation. There's a very good chance it could happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing in Boxing 24 was that he warned both of them to stay away from Tyson Fury. That could be the end of their career.
We've always disagreed on this, and good thing Dr. Chris is not on here. But you guys know I'm a much bigger supporter of Tyson Fury than you guys are, than you two are. Tyson Fury, one thing Zito and I have always recognized is stylistically Tyson Fury will give either one of these guys fits. He will absolutely give Joshua Wilder fits. Whether he regains the form that would allow him to be able to overcome those guys, that's a different matter. But just stylistically, styles make fights. We know that. He gives them fits. What Lennox Lewis recognizes is that Tyson Fury could give one of them fits to the point of they losing their title, and again, that fight goes down the drain. Not that other fights still aren't there, but right now you have the two alpha dogs in a heavyweight division. When it happened during Lennox's time, that fight never materialized. So obviously Lennox is like, look, get this fight done. Because, you know, I mean, you guys are vulnerable guys too.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Tyson Fury, it's all contingent on if Tyson Fury regains any sort of form from the present, from the past.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying he needs to regain enough of it. Don't know if he can. Don't know if he can. If he does, then I don't see either guy beating the Tyson Fury that beat Klitschko, that form of Klitschko. And I don't see either guy beating a slightly lesser form of Tyson Fury, though. I don't know. You know, it is boxing. You have to kind of stay strong. And now you're going up against guys who are hungry, and they're you know, these guys have been a little sharper. So
mm-hmm.
just to get in, you might be better, but timing's everything. Timing means everything. It could be Deontay's time to land that one on your chin. It could be that time for you not to take it. It could be AJ's time to go ahead and hit you with a combination that you weren't ready for. Your time not to be able to stand up to it. Timing means everything.
Did you just hear what you said? And one thing I mentioned was Tyson Fury gives him fits if he gets back in the form. But did you hear something you just said? And I want to point this out. Right, so we talk about the heavyweight champions. We talk about, you know, obviously Joshua is the number one guy, and he's considered the heavyweight champion. Deontay Wilder, I think, you know, is obviously considered the guy right there. There was a statement made about Joshua being, you know, the number one heavyweight, but Wilder being the baddest man on the planet. I just want to peek into the comments that Z made in a Freudian sort of way. Z said, maybe if it were AJ, you know, catches you, you know, with that combination, gets you out of there. He said, with Deontay Wilder, he catches you with that shot. Zito wasn't making a point about power, but in his discussion and just talking, just speaking naturally without really even it being in reference to the two combatants, he was talking specifically about Tyson Fury, but just him speaking, he was like, Deontay catches you with a shot. Joshua catches you with a combination. What makes Deontay Wilder so dangerous? What makes Deontay Wilder so dangerous? Whether you like his technique, whether you like his form, whether you like his fundamentals, he catches you with a shot. Tyson Fury, against Deontay Wilder, he has to not get caught with a certain shot. Against Joshua, he has to not be in position to get caught with certain shots. I think that's a very valid point that doesn't get looked at enough.
Well, styles make the fight. That's the thing. Styles make the fight.
Yes, sir.
and really, I mean, at the moment, I think both styles, Fury, I mean, he's going to need to get in a very, very sharper form. Everybody could talk about condition and everything. He has to be boxing sharp. Boxing sharp, I mean, to know what's going on. to be able to react to what's going on at all times, in all circumstances.
And like you said, Zito, condition is one thing. He's already starting to look in great shape. Look in great shape. But when we talk about sharpness and form and getting back to that level that defeated Vladimir Klitschko, here's the thing that we both know. Deontay Wilder and Anthony Joshua are not going to stand pat and sit outside content to not attack Tyson Fury and be befuddled by his jab and movement. They are going to bring the fight to Tyson Fury. Vladimir Klitschko, even though Tyson Fury beat Vladimir Klitschko was neutered by Tyson Fury fighting a fight similar to Vladimir Klitschko.
He had no idea
how to step in and attack. Anthony Joshua steps in to attack. That's how he fights.
Mm-hmm.
Although Deontay Wilder doesn't do that, Deontay Wilder just has too much dog in him to not step in to do what he needs to do. So he faces significantly more threat in Anthony Joshua and Deontay Wilder than he did that night with Klitschko. So Zito is absolutely right. He has to be pinpoint accurate and sharp to be able to overcome either one of those guys.
And then
here's another question I want to ask you. Tomas Adamek, has a chance to advance the division and turn it on its ear if he beats Big Baby Miller. What's your thoughts on that one?
I think it's ridiculous that Big Baby Miller is fighting Thomas Adamek. That's my thought. Thomas Adamek is a guy who retired three times, in the last 5 years. He's basically just been fighting in Poland against, nondescript competition. Big Baby Miller is sitting as the number two or three contender in three of the sanctioning body organizations. What he's obviously doing is holding on to his spot so he could try to goad one of the titleists into fighting him, specifically Anthony Joshua, more than likely. He's already pulled out of Eliminator with Kulbet Pulev. He pulled out of Eliminator with Dillon White. Big Baby Miller right now, for all his braggadocio, and he's a great, funny guy behind the mic, but he's a guy who has a very thin resume. And there have been opportunities for him to step up his resume, but I think he's looking at the business model and recognizing by him holding pat in the position he is and by not necessarily fighting anyone in front of him, he can kind of have a title shot fall into his lap by default. That's good business for him, but as far as him fighting Adamek, it's not a fight I'm interested in. It's not a fight that should be happening. I wish Adamek the best, but it's not a fight I even care to break down or analyze because that's kind of what's wrong with the sport right now. Jarrell Miller is, and I love Big Baby, but he's in a position he's never really earned, and he's looking to get an unearned title shot as well. But that is the business, and that's what happens, all the time nowadays. Mm-hmm. So it is what it is, but it's a sham. I'm sorry.
Yeah, take a look at the number of fights he's had. And in fact, he really burst on the scene in about 18 months ago with a hail of publicity. It just seems that the owners and managers have pushed him, and now I guess he thinks he's entitled.
Well, I mean, he is, and here's the thing, right? He's well in line for the winner of Manuel Char against Prez Akendo fighting for some WBA regular belt. When we know Joshua is the WBA champion, but he's like in line for that. So if he fights anybody that's rated above him, it'll be Prez Akendo or Manuel Char. Why they're rated above him in any sanctioning body organization, I don't know. But then again, they have better resumes. That's what's going on. Guys are playing politics and angling for title shots as opposed to going out necessarily and fighting the people to make a mandate for a title shot. The one guy who is doing that is Dillon White. Dillon White is fighting whoever they put in front of him, basically. All kudos and credit to him. That's part of the reason why the boxing scene in the United Kingdom is bristling and the boxing scene in the United States is stagnant because you have guys who aren't taking up the mantle to fight challenges and put on necessarily entertaining fights. Not that Adamek is not an entertaining fighter, but Adamek is a guy who's well past his best, who's 40 years old who's been fighting kind of part-time over these past few years. And here's a guy who's screaming for a title shot. Here's a guy who's on stage with Anthony Joshua talking trash, yet Ademik is the guy you're fighting. Come on. I can't take you seriously.
Who are the last three guys that Miller has fought? Has he increased in the level of competition?
Not at all.
So, to me, I mean, he's going to Thomas Ademik. At this stage, he's majorly decreased. He's taking a guy who, I mean, to be honest, I mean, he made his bones not at heavyweight. I mean, he moved up to heavyweight and he didn't do bad. But, I mean, to be honest, he didn't make his, you know, he didn't make his bones
at
natural heavyweight.
Yeah.
Exactly.
He's a light heavyweight cruiserweight, yeah.
He's a light, exactly. He didn't make it. Yeah,
you're
thinking
of an old
heavyweight.
Small guy. You're thinking of an old small guy at that. Yeah.
Exactly. He didn't go up to heavyweight and do bad, but the guy made his bones at cruiserweight, spent his career down at lower than heavyweight. So now you're going to get an older version of him, of far removed from retirement nearly version of him, to go ahead and fight and to make a name off of yourself. After fighting these last two, it's not like you went ahead and you fought Dillon Whyte and Derek Chisora back to back, and then you say, you know what, I'm gonna try to take a little, you know, take a, you know, maybe an easier fight. Look at the past two opponents, and then you go fight Thomas Ademik. To be honest, that doesn't even, like, even marketing wise, that kind of turns me off. It's like what are you trying to do with this guy? You're taking him downstream instead of, you know, taking him up the mountain. Do you want to see that? I mean, even the perimeter boxing fan, I love, you know, even the people who love Thomas Ademik know that he's past it, especially at heavyweight. Fighting a guy who's almost 300 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and Thomas Ademik is what? I mean, he's got to be, what 40, what?
Got to be at least 40, I would imagine.
Yeah,
around 40, if not a little older.
Yeah. Yeah, he has to be around 40. So, I mean, come on now. It's not credible. It's not advancing.
No, the best thing you could say about Ademik as an opponent is there's a large Polish contingent in Chicago, and we know Ademik sells tickets. That's about it. That really is about it.
Mm-hmm.
For Ademik, this is, you know, a shot to return to some level of glory. This is a horrible, and I think the world of Ademik, but just the fact that he's, you know, a smaller, older guy. It's just, this is the fight you see. This is the kind of fight you see when a guy's coming up. You know, when you have a prospect who has, like, you know, 12 fights, and he takes on a smaller, older guy. Like, when we go to Dover Downs to watch a fight, you know, we see a lot of four or six rounders where we see a guy who really looks about, you know, two weight classes bigger than a guy who's like 15 years older than him. That, we see that when, you know, prospects are matched on the way up, you're trying to build confidence. I'm not trying to see that with a guy who's barking in the heavyweight champion's face. That's bullshit. I'm sorry. I love Big Baby. Big Baby Miller comes from Muay Thai background. I love him because of that. but I love the fact that he's articulate, you know. And so there's certain things that I really root for the guy. But this is tragic. This is why the sport suffers in the United States the way it does. You know, we're going to have some mismatches. And this might not even turn out to be a mismatch for all I know. But, the fact of the matter is, for all I care, and that's the problem, you know, you're not giving the fans anything to care about. Like, when a fight is made, specifically a guy who's, you know, standing on stage barking in the heavyweight champion's face, that's a guy I expect to go out there and say, you know what, let me make a mandate for that shot. You don't do that by fighting a 40-year-old cruiserweight. I'm sorry. That's just absolutely ridiculous. I love the guy.
There are other heavyweights out there to fight. Lord of mercy.
Even from a matchmaking standpoint, even if you want to just get some rounds and you don't want a challenge per se, you could fight other people, though. This is ridiculous.
Even from a marketing standpoint, I mean, if you're, even you can go to UK and fight David Price. Why don't you do that? Maybe you won't beat David Price.
That's a good one though, David Price. I mean, why not? That's Jesus. Well, at least find a heavyweight guy. You know what I mean?
That's what I mean. And maybe with some vulnerabilities that are seen. But as I say, maybe it's a confidence thing. Maybe they're putting people in front of him that he can beat and quote look good unquote in front of. So, I don't know. When they put him in front of somebody, and when they really put him in front of the good competition, we'll see.
And, you know, here's the thing. You know, if you're in a ring with a guy like a Demick with you know, the miles and the knowledge that guy has, you say to yourself, well, you know what, sharing a ring with a Demick for 12 rounds, I can learn a lot. But not if you're just going to beat him with size and activity. You're not going to learn anything because you're just going to overwhelm him with size and activity. So what are you really going to learn? What are you really going to have to adjust and pull out of your tool and your repertoire to beat a Demick with? You're not. You're just going to beat him by being 300 pounds, 6'4", and throwing, you know, hundreds of punches. So I completely agree with Zito. He doesn't necessarily learn anything. So not only to me does this really do nothing for his boxing acumen, but it does nothing for his brand either. Like I said, it doesn't create a mandate for a title. It doesn't make him look like a world beater. I don't care if he goes out there and blows a Demick out in one round. No one's going to make – it doesn't make him look more formidable. So, to me, not only does this do nothing for him as an actual fighter, but it does nothing for his brand. And, to me, that's not a winning proposition.
The other one that caught my eye was Jorge Linares trying to get back into shape so he can get back and make a possible run at 140 weight against, I guess it's Jorge Zepka. I've never heard of the guy. But Linares, we talked about him for years. He's got to be, wouldn't you think he's about too old to get back into the thing, Ty?
Oh, no, not at all. Not after that magnificent performance he just had against Lomachenko. Linares, no, not at all. He may be not his best. He may not be peak, but I think he's still prime. You know what I mean? He just ran into a better fighter. You know, up until that point, you know, he was considered the number one guy in that weight class. And I still think a fight with him and Mikey would be marvelous for however long it lasted. I still would favor Mikey to beat him. But no more than I would favor Mikey to beat him before. You know what I mean? I don't think Linares, not at all. Linares is, I think there's no way we can look at how he performed against Lomachenko and be like, oh, this guy's past it. Not at all.
I actually was impressed with him. I think he should keep going on. 140, I don't know how his durability or his shell is going to be at 140. I predict that it's not going to be that good. It's not the best at 135. But really, that's his only weakness, to be honest. He has some holes. Every boxer has holes. But, I mean, to be honest, that's his only weakness. He's a tremendously talented, skilled, and smart fighter. So, I mean, he definitely could go up and be successful against Suarez. I don't think against everybody. I don't think he's a necessary. Well, 140? I don't know. Depends who's at 140 at the time.
I you know what? Because he's coming up from 126, and I mean, Linares doesn't take a horrible shot. Linares' problem, like Zito said, is durability. His face cuts up. And Linares has a problem with the physicality of a fight. Literally the physicality of a fight. And before I would even – I don't personally – I've heard the speculation about 140, but I believe it when I see it. I think he's suited for 135. I don't think the physicality of 140 suits him. And I really would be surprised if his team went up to 140 unless he's really, really – having a hard time making the weight, which I hadn't heard anything. But then again, he no longer is the best guy at 135, so sometimes that causes a fighter to move up. But again, I would question his physicality at 140. You know, some of those guys, you know, like Pro Gray, although Pro Gray is going to get touched up if he fights Linares, he's a guy Linares can't get hit by. You know what I mean? So there's just, you know, some of those guys at 140, you know, they're a lot bigger. And Linares is not the biggest, you know, guy when it comes to that weight, you know, that weight range. So I'd be surprised if he ventured into 140. But at the same time, you know, he's a warrior, so who knows?
Well,
and there's a part of me that's like,
yo,
he's a guy who could keep campaigning at 135. There's still some fights for him there. A fight with him and Robert Easter would be awesome. Also, he's a guy who I could see wanting to chase a rematch with Lomachenko, because before he got stopped with that body shot, he was in the fight. The fight was even, for my money, until he got stopped. He had worked himself back into the fight. So you never know. You never know.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about two straight losses for Parker, Joseph Parker? Do you think he should retire, or do you think he should go back to the back to working out and figuring out what his problem is?
I think out of everything I read this week, that was the thing that actually pissed me off the most, that there was speculation whether a 26-year-old fighter should retire. What the fuck, excuse my language, is going on in the sport today where the sport is filled with a bunch of soft-ass media members and fighters, that a 26-year-old fighter who lost two fights at the highest level by decision should retire? That is insane to me. That is insane. That is absolutely insane. That's where we live, where a guy can't lose a fight. How many times did fighters lose fights in a row back in the 30s and 40s and 50s? And they just kept fighting. He had two bad days at the office. To me, his issue is that he's kind of stagnated. It seems like when he gets in the middle of the fight, he doesn't quite want it enough, or he doesn't know how to attack without putting himself in certain positions, and he's not willing to put himself in certain positions. This is a mentality thing. He has all the tools. But to even speculate that a kid at 26 years old, who is on top of the world in this country, who's lost two close decisions to a heavyweight champion and a top five rated contender should retire? I can't even talk about it anymore because I'll cuss everyone out on the show. That is absolutely ridiculous. He's not 46. He's 26 at heavyweight. Ridiculous.
And what I see, to be honest, is he's kind of is a classic case of a front runner. I don't want to judge. I don't want to, you know, speculate, but it looks to me like he's a classic case of a true front runner. You go through the guys that go through grade school that are best basketball players have the trophy. They go to high school, they're recruited, best, they win a championship, they have the team captain, they have the trophy. Go to college, Dallas, they have the trophy. Go to the pros, get the championship, they're the star guys. But then they lose.
Mm-hmm.
And then they lose again.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're like, well, wow, I'm not that guy. I'm not the guy on top. And then in the fashion they lose. They didn't lose going out on their shield necessarily. And not saying he's not a warrior, not saying anything like that, but against Joshua, he shied away. Against White, he was made to shy away. So, to be honest, I mean, even in, within the performances, you see the front runner-ism. So, and you see that a lot in guys who are front runners when they finally, even in, they lose in front runner fashion, that's kind of how front runners do. You get that front runner mentality. Oh man, I can't win. I'm not the winner anymore. Kind of win it quick. You kind of get that dejected down side of it to where they don't. They not saying they don't know how to lose, but they don't know how to lose and they don't know how to take it, and they look negatively on it. Like, you know, since I lost this, I'm nothing. I can't do it. And you get that. So I think it's a matter of confidence. And if he feels that way, he might not want to get in the ring because he might perform that way. So he needs to think about exactly what he wants to do.
Well, I'm going to disagree with Z. Is I don't be a front runner with Joseph Parker. And part of the reason why is, God forbid I got to say this, but I saw him dig deep against Carlos Takam. Yeah, but he dug deep. What I see with Joseph Parker, and I don't see a guy who gets dejected during a fight, he does. After a fight, never. Never dejected after a fight. I don't see that at all. What I see with Joseph Parker is, first of all, we're hardcore boxing fans. If we're doing a boxing radio show, we're hardcore boxing fans. And the fact of the matter is we like our fighters to have this live-and-die passion when they get in the ring. Not everybody's like that. Joseph Parker, what he is to me, and I've analyzed this well before the Dillon White, well before he lost, and it's just based on certain comments. And then specifically the comments after the Joshua fight, the comments after the Dillon White fight, what he is he's a sportsman. He's a sportsman, kind of like Kermit Cintron, but God forbid, not like Kermit Cintron, but a sportsman in the sense that this is not a live-or-die thing for him. This is something he likes doing, and it's a sport. It's literally a sport to him. So in the ring, he's not the kind of guy who's going to walk through fire necessarily because he doesn't have that live-or-die passion. When he fought Takam, he showed me he wasn't a front-runner because Takam pulled him into something that he didn't want to be in, and he fought back. Again, with Takam, he didn't have to walk through the type of fire he had to walk through with Dillon White and Anthony Joshua. He wasn't willing to do that. He was trying to look for a sporting way to go ahead and win the fight. But a guy who, after the fight, makes the kind of comments he does is not a guy. He wasn't dejected at all. In fact, his whole thing was like, I don't know why everybody was so dejected. I just lost the fight. It's not the end of the world. Everybody's telling him to retire. He's like, I just lost the fight. He's a sportsman. He's not one of these guys who's like Margarito. Remember, Zito, we talk about this all the time. Margarito said he would die in a ring. Cotto said, you're stupid. You're stupid if you die in a ring. Some guys have that live-and-die passion. As fight fans, we want our guys to have that. Some guys, it's just a sport to them. And if they lose, they just lose, just like losing a basketball game. I read so much from Joseph Parker after that fight because I was so flabbergasted that people were saying a 26-year-old needs to retire. And I know they were saying that because they said, oh, mentality-wise, he doesn't seem like he wants it. And then when I started analyzing and reading his comments, yeah, he does want it. He wants it just the way LeBron James wants to go ahead and win a championship. But if Draymond Green punches LeBron James in the face, he's not going to shoot the damn shot because he's not going to walk through that type of fire. He's a basketball player. He's a sportsman. Joseph Parker's a sportsman. He's not that blood and guts fighter that we make all our fighters out to be. That's not who he is. And he's accepted that, so I think it's incumbent upon people that watch him to accept that. If he decides he wants to be that blood and guts fighter, if all of a sudden something's triggered in him and he decides to walk through that fire, then that's on him. But I'm not going to call for a 26-year-old guy who is still a top 10 heavyweight to retire because he chooses not to walk through fire in all of his fights. That's his decision.
Mm-hmm. Smart.
Oh, no, everybody doesn't walk through fire.
It is ultimately.
Everyone doesn't walk through fire.
Yeah, ultimately, it is just a sport. And if some guys just take it as a sport, those are guys, obviously, us as fans aren't going to be as passionate about. But who am I to tell a guy you shouldn't continue in a sport because you're not as passionate about it as me, who is sitting on the sidelines and only commenting on you actually fighting?
Right.
That's bullshit. That is such bullshit.
Yeah, nobody should tell him. But now, if he's contemplating it, then that's a problem. That's the problem. He needs to think about
that's on him.
If his team,
but you
if
know
his
said,
team,
Zito,
I know his team
said,
was talking something.
Fight. He said, Zito, he said, all I did, he said, I just lost the fight. It's not the end of the world. He said that.
That's the truth.
Because it was ridiculous.
That's what I think too.
He's my God. Yeah.
That's what I think too. I heard talk, I mean, I don't know how exact relevant, but I heard talk of his team. You know how their teams talk. But
the big thing was everybody was saying he should dump his trainer and move on with another trainer. And then he's like, I lost the fight. Why is this world is falling thing? He's like, I just lost the fight. And this is a guy who's never, he hasn't been blown out in his fights. But I think also what we have to recognize is, no disrespect, but he struggled against Carlos Takam. He struggled against Andy Ruiz. He struggled against Yuri Fury. Right now he's a certain level. But again, This is a guy who's younger than Joshua and Wilder, and yet people are calling for him to retire because he's lost two fights in a row by close decision. What in the world is going on with boxing when you can't even lose a freaking fight at 26? Unbelievable.
Pacquiao lost fights, and nobody called for him to retire.
Well, remember, he did have a falling out with one of his favorite fans, Mr. Arum. And I'm not sure that you saw. Did you see the announcement this morning that Mr. Arum flew all the way to the Philippines today after the stuff he said about? Yeah, after the stuff he talked about.
Pacquiao's kind of funny because Pacquiao had made a lot of comments that, you know, he didn't like certain things. Then, of course, he you know, hires Boo Boy as his trainer. Freddie Roach finds out through the media. But he also said he was, you know, doing his own thing and no Top Rank. But Top Rank distributed the broadcast, the fight for him. He's also made comments that, oh, I would work with Freddie Roach and Top Rank again. So, Manny Pacquiao says a lot of things, I think, in the heat of the moment, but I think he knows. I mean, he does. He kind of always still does the familiar things. You know, he's one of those guys.
Yeah, Pacquiao's going to go where the money is.
Where he's comfortable.
He needs to make money, and it's time to fight, and that's where he's going to get the money from. He's going to go where he knows where to get the money from.
Well,
he's been doing business like that for years.
I think one of the problems he has at this point is he found out just how hard it is to raise the money to put the fight on, and what's all involved in the fight to be put on. So now his idea may be to go back to Arum, but Arum certainly realized how much money he could lose or win with coming back with Pacquiao. So I'm sure that's all part of the conversation this week.
Well, Arum never wanted. I mean, Arum wanted to maintain status quo. It was Pacquiao who went ahead and booked his whole fight in Malaysia on his own. So, but I think, like you said, Pacquiao, he talked about how much harder it was to promote.
And you know, you brought up Eddie Hearn earlier, and I happened to see his comment this week. It just absolutely floored me. He said that Amir Khan will not make a move up to 150 or 154 to fight with Kell Brook, and the Kell Brook is going to have to come down.
That's always been stated, always been assumed. That's always what it was going to be. If the fight does come off, it was clear. Like, it was never even speculated that that fight would take place at 154. No one speculated that. It's a statement that didn't need to be made. Khan is only going to fight at 147. The moment he got knocked out by Canelo, well, not the moment because he was unconscious, but shortly after he got knocked out by Canelo, he said that, you know, 154 was too big. He would only campaign at 147. When he signed with Eddie Hearn, because that's what made the fight realistic, when Khan signed with Hearn, and it was speculated. He said then, well, it would take place at 147. So, I mean, that's non-news. If the fight takes place, because we still don't even know if Khan will actually take the fight. We know Brooke wants the fight. We don't know if Khan will take it.
Sure.
But 147 is the only place it would take place.
Mm-hmm. If Khan will take the fight under all concessions going to him. As simple as that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Including more than 50% of the purse, I'm sure.
Khan will take the fight if he has no place to go for that money. Right now, Khan is thinking Pacquiao again. If he has no place to go for it, it's getting to the point where he has to take the book fight because that's a big fight in England. But, again, Khan is the guy who's really going for the money fight. So that's why that fight all of a sudden, because Kell Brook raised his profile with the Triple G thing and the Spence thing, even though he lost, he really raised his profile. And that fight is even more lucrative now. So that's why that fight can happen now, but it couldn't happen at the time.
Well, our last story of the week is going to be, I had lunch with Dan Birmingham the other day, and he allowed me to have the information that Mr. Keith Thurman will be returning to the ring probably in August. I'm sorry, in the late part of the year against Joselito Lopez.
You know, I read October. Joselito Lopez, to me, I give Keith Thurman credit. I think that's a bold pick. I mean, Joselito, you know, he's getting to that a little bit past the point. He's taking some beatings. But still, coming off a damn near two-year layoff, Joselito is a live guy because he's a guy who he never comes to lose. So I think off a two-year layoff, that's a live pick.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with Ty. Joselito, he's a live pick. He's not dangerous for Keith. Well, he shouldn't be dangerous. Everybody's dangerous, but he shouldn't be dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But he's the kind of guy that, let me say this, because, you know, Keith has had the injuries, because he's gotten married, the media, the boxing media questions his motivation at this point in time. You know what I mean? And they question whether Keith wants it like that. A fight against Joselito Lopez is a truth machine. So he's the kind of guy where if you're not motivated, you could end up in a fight you don't want to have, Victor Ortiz. So to me, this is a bold pick, and it's a statement pick. If he goes out there and does what he's supposed to do against Joselito Lopez, not that Joselito's on a prime sharp Keith Thurman's level, but coming off a two-year layoff, I don't question fighting Joselito, that's a statement about his motivation because he could easily be pulled into a hard fight that he wins every round, but a hard fight. So it says a lot to me.
Yeah. And he could easily fight somebody else of lesser quality.
Coming off that time, yeah.
Yeah. So.
How many times have we said that in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah.
Even Brady was bringing that up 2 weeks ago about some of the fights and the difference. But
Keith could make a Thomas Ademik Gerald Miller choice if he wanted to, but he's not. So.
Mm-hmm.
and legitimately.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, that brings our program to the end tonight. We want to thank everybody for listening. We also want to thank our sponsors, Dr. Kathleen Carroll. And don't forget, if you're ever thinking about buying or selling a home in Manatee County or Sarasota County, go with Weicker Realty and the team of Joseph Giordano. Guys, I want to thank you guys for being there again tonight, bringing everything that you have in your armamentarium. I can't buy those teeth by airmail anymore. The tongue keeps getting in the way, for God's sake. And Z, give us another shout for your program.
The gym is called the Fight Factory, Ellesmere Boxing Club. We are on 340 Robinson Lane off of Maryland Avenue. We're generally open all day, but you can come in from like maybe what 4 to 9, four to whenever, to be honest, depending who's in there. But we're in there at night. So, you know, come on in, kids. Anybody aspiring to fight?
Yeah, I think the impressive thing about it is what you did this summer with kids and having them come there and actually work out with everybody and to keep them off the street. This is a very tough time, as I say at the end of every show, both domestically and foreign for those men and women in uniform, and it's a very tough time in the city of Wilmington, the city of Chester, and the Philadelphia area. So any program that can get kids into positive thinking, positive manners, is first in our minds. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Our programs are always on every night of the week. And they're always in grateful appreciation to the men and women of the United States Armed Forces, the men and women of Police and Fire Services. When you're out there and you see somebody in a uniform, please let them know you know they're there. A simple handshake and wink. I was so proud of my grandkids. Every time we run into somebody, they'll walk up and they'll shake hands and say, thank you for your service or thank you for being there for me. And that the gut, that just the smile that comes over the officer's face, or the lady's face, or the deputy's face, or the military personnel's face, is worth a thousand words. These programs are dedicated to those who've lost their lives in the line of duty: Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman David Curtis, Patrolman Jeffrey Kolkamp, Sergeant Thomas Bager, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazowitz, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, San Diego Officer Mike Hendler, Lieutenant Mike Zerbin, New Castle County Police, Patrolman Anafa Crispin, Lakeland PD, Chief Al Hogo, Wollongong Key Police Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Highway Patrolman Alonzo Moses, Philadelphia Highway Patrol, Highway Patrolman Brian Lazaro, Philadelphia Highway Patrol, Highway Patrolman Brian Murphy, Plymouth Township, PA Highway Patrol, Lieutenant Bob Neary, Philadelphia Fire Department, Sergeant Mike Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Office, Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, Deputy Jonathan Scott Pine, Orange County Sheriff's Office, Patrolman Robert Jermaine, Windermere, Florida Police Department, Trooper Chelsea Richards, Florida Highway Patrol, Lieutenant Joyce Craig Lewis, Philadelphia Fire Department, Patrolman Charlie Condit, Carpenter Springs Police Department, Hillsborough County Deputy Sheriff Charlie Kotloff, Delaware State Trooper Sergeant Ronnie Bond, Captain Chris Leach, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Jerry Ficus, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Ardith Hope, Wilmington Fire Department, FDLE Special Inspectors Vinnie Galaccio, Delaware State Trooper Corporal Stephen Ballard, Kissimmee Patrol Officer Matt Baxter, Kissimmee Sergeant Sam Howard, Captain Matt Letourneau, Philadelphia Fire Department, and Deputy Bill Gentry, Highland County Sheriff's Office. My brothers and sisters, although you may be 10-7 at this point in time, at some time we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Until that time, may the roads rise up to meet you. May the winds be always at your back. May the rains fall soft on your fields. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your family always in the hallow of his hands. Good night. God bless.
Shemalek ma'ilama, shemahezahilma, sona shenevoratfet, hakuigegen ma'ilma.
All units be advised, 19-9 responded to his last emergency. May God rest his soul.